So thank you for your really thoughtful questions. They're great. You know, it was suggested that I can just read from the questions themselves, but if you want to ask them again, that would be nice too, just because it makes it more alive. Otherwise, it's kind of, thank you, dear, lecture form, and I don't care to I'm not a good lecturer. I prefer the immediate exchange, the live exchange. But I can see very lively minds and really interesting directions opening up. And some of the questions are very much the questions that, you know, many of us are asking. Certainly many Muslims are asking, and also people in other traditions. There is a move today to broaden the traditions, each of our traditions, and to find the universal aspects of our tradition, because I think today there's a longing in all of us to find peace with each other and to come to the state of feeling that we are truly one human family. And so we must look at the things that divide us, you know, and both in an obvious way and in more subtle ways. So ultimately, we say on our Sufi path and Sufi work that ultimately what divides us is our ego. And we call the ego the limited self. So, you know, it's something that is seemingly part of our constitution as human beings. It's something that Allah, it's something part of the creation. But it's also something we need to go beyond, just like you could say a butterfly needs to come out of the cocoon, or a flower or a fruit out of its own husk. It has to, or a seed, burst open to become completely what it is and what its potential is. And so the human being has an enormous potential that we're really not aware of. A very little, let's say, in our world. And our vision of the human being is very confined and narrow in, you know, both academic circles and in society as a whole, in the world. So some of the traditions have the true vision, or let's say something of the true vision of what the human potential is. And that's what we want to develop, and that's what we want to cultivate, and that's what we strive for in the Sufi path, is really to be truly the fullness, to achieve the fullness of how Allah intended us to be, or desires us to be, because there's always that question between what is and then what could be. You know, is this Allah's will, or is it? There is a difference between Allah's pleasure and Allah's will, you might say, almost. So we strive to achieve and to reach and taste Allah's pleasure. And to do that, we must go beyond our limited ego, because that is not the full reality. So these questions, you know, some of them definitely touched on that. But why don't we start again? I'd also like to say that in this time, as we said, I think there is an urgency and a longing to come together and to see our fundamental essential unity of all human beings. And that's a great desire. And that will help make the peace. And then, of course, uniqueness. We are all, in fact, the Sufi path is very much a path of uniqueness. No two creatures are alike, no two human beings are alike, no two moments in creation are alike. It says Allah is always creating anew. Every instant so is different from the preceding instant. So we might look at the world and we think, oh, it's just the same, especially if we wake up in a bad mood or everything's the same. Well, it's not. You know, that's just our glasses that are telling us that. the real creation is pure and created anew, instantaneously and moment by moment, freshly. So that's also, we want to live in that fresh state, because that's the state when we're really happy, is when we feel that like fountain of life coming through us and we can feel new. So, you know, the human being, it's said, is the crown of creation. So it's not easy, though, to be the crown of creation. You know, it's a lot of responsibility to grow and to discover and even suffer. For suffering is part of our reality. It's part of the reality of being on earth. So, but how we see the suffering, how we can interpret the suffering, helps us. If we see it really as a means to polishing the mirror of our heart, or as a means to maturing us, you know, then it's a much better suffering than if we feel we're suffering needlessly. That's the worst thought, is to say, well, all this suffering is happening in humanity and it's just pointless, you know. That's terrible. What's the worst is a pointless life, is a life that is lived unfulfilled, unrealized, where the treasure of the in the human heart is not discovered. So our own, you know, Sufi lineage is very much about discovering that treasure. So we are, yes, in a way, treasure seekers.
Can you talk a little bit more about that lineage part? Because that, so just as an introduction, and I think last time also we had spoken about it, that we are followers of His Highness the Aga Khan.
Yes, alhamdulillah. And,
yes, so.
What a blessing.
Based on that, we also do connect to Prophet Muhammad through his lineage. Mm-hmm. And so we just want to understand, and these are still young kids who are trying to kind of identify what our faith is and how it kind of ties in, how it ties into
spirituality. To other faiths and other lineages.
Right, and what that concept, so we give them our perspective of how that concept ties in, but hearing it from
yes.
a perspective would
yes.
be very helpful.
Yes. My understanding, of course, this is only my limited understanding, is that Allah is infinite, Allah is boundless, and infinitely creative. And therefore, I like to think that there is not just one lineage, you know. Of course, we've seen many prophets come. Some say 124,000, others say 224,000. Noble beings called prophets and messengers have come to humanity to remind humanity and to exactly point to the reality of the human being and the divine reality. This is the treasure. The real treasure is Allah, you know, within, we say. And I know that you are mystical, you know, the more mystical for the inner and the inner interpretation, which is interesting because that's very much also a Sufi way, you know, in comparison to the Shariatic way, which is more the outer and the outer fulfillment of certain, you know, obligatory relationship. Well, you know, I personally would never be able to live that. What inspires me and gives me courage and feeling of, you know, wanting to wake up and be living every day is that mystical relation of the heart to God, of the heart to Allah, and to feel that Allah is always revealing something new, you know, and ever deeper and deeper realities of love, of beauty, of mystery unfolding. So that can only be accessed through a mystical path, but of which I feel you were all part of. I feel so, you know, already the sense of a lineage is a mystical thing. The pure Shariatic people don't even so much look at lineage. But it's not, I don't want to, we're not here to criticize or to, you know, set anyone else apart. Everyone follows their own nature ultimately, and this goes back to Allah's infinite creativity, that although the essence of humanity, you might say, is all, you know, the same, and we all come from the same source and we're all returning to the same source, and we are all sustained by the same being, moment by moment, cherished, yet we all have our different paths, and there are different doors and different things that inspire us. So this is part of my understanding, you know, of the different traditions. And then within each tradition, there are, again, uniquenesses and different lineages within. Look at Christianity, you know, how many, you know, different Christian groups there are within this one teaching of Jesus, alayhi salam. So I think the nature of humanity is diversity. But what we want to find is the unity within the diversity. And I think that's a very important quest today. So our lineage comes through, you know, the Prophet, peace be upon him, and the noble and the great Ali, radiallahu an, and then through Hassan al-Basri, who was one of the As-Sufa, you know, but he was a companion of the time. He was a great... he so much loved the Prophet that he wanted to remember everything he said. And so once he addressed him and he said, "Oh, Rasulullah, I don't know. I hear you speak these pearls of wisdom, but I can't retain them in my memory." And so Rasulullah said to him, "Well, open your sit and open your skirt and your cloak." And Abu Huraira did that, and then the Rasul, peace be upon him, made a gesture and a prayer and threw something, but it was invisible, into the lap of Abu Huraira. And it is said, after that prayer, he never after forgot anything. So he became one of the great transmitters. So, you know, our line is through him. But what you realize is that these are like underground roots. So it might seem like one line, but they are underground. They're constant. So instead of underground, think of in a heavenly, you know, dimension or a soul level. They're all interconnecting. Mm-hmm. So I very strongly feel, even though we have a very specific lineage, heart to heart, and this is how the transmission has come, just as you have. It's very clear, and you can name all the people on it, all the transmitters. But what we don't see, what's more invisible, are the cross currents between these lines of transmission, so that they form almost like a tapestry. So they are not really separate. They're constantly interacting, just like, you know, when you sometimes see a tree fallen over and then you look at its roots and it's amazing, and they're all, you know, the big roots, which are, you could say, the main lines of transmission, and then there are all kind of branching roots and smaller, and they're all interconnecting, and in this way they feed each other and they learn from each other. This is how I see lineage. It's very interesting. So from a divine point of view, it's more like a tapestry. So that is, you know, simply one little tiny drop of a drop in answer of lineage. Well, it's important.
Yes,
and, absolutely.
Last time, I think you had shared, and it was very interesting, how that transmission occurs, and I believe in the tariqah is through dreams, and if you want to explain that a little bit.
Yes, that would be you mean how the successors are designated.
Correct.
Yeah, that is interesting. So, really, they're divinely designated. In other words, it's known, of course, to Allah, every successor of every lineage and every human being. And this is, of course, bewildering. Our mind cannot conceive of this divine knowledge, of this divine, you know, omniconsciousness, let's call it. But as we experience it, we, as of course, from our own human point of view, we are guided to the successors through dreams. And particularly in this, I don't know if all the, you know, turuqs are like that, all the tariqas, or if it's just some, but in our lineage, the successor is shown through dream. So in that sense, it's not a mistake. It's not like, well, human beings choose the follower And then you can say, well, that really wasn't a good choice. You know, they made a mistake. So even, let's say, in a lineage, in a succession, if the person, well, maybe they're not so great, but still we have the consciousness, this is the divine choice. This is Allah's choice. And we must accept that and learn from that and be grateful. So it's a very, it puts us in the place of peace. This is what it said in Quran, in fact, you know, that don't worry about what has passed you by, and don't, you know, don't fret after it. If, then it was not meant for you. And it said, if Allah desires something for you, no one and nothing can stop it. And if it is not meant for you, nothing can bring it about. And in part, that teaching makes us, well, okay, then you stop striving and fretting for things that maybe are not meant to be. And then it helps settle the heart and makes us more grateful for simply what is here already. What is here now is immense. You know, it's interesting. I woke up this morning, it was gray and rainy. I was thinking, oh my goodness, you know, it goes on and gray and rainy. I was thinking, and then I was thinking, and you know, feeling spiritually kind of down and feeling like almost kind of a sense of foreboding. And then I was sitting at breakfast and eating, then all of a sudden I realized, Fariha, just be grateful. And it totally turned everything around. And I was all of a sudden grateful for my food, and then the day seemed different. If we can just bring that gratitude to what is here, right now, the way we are, without any change, is amazing. Yeah, alhamdulillah. So, yes.
If you can just tell us a little background about yourself.
Sure.
Were you born in this?
No, I was born, yes, I was born in Houston, Texas, to French parents who came over just after the war, during the war. My father was he was in the resistance, so he could not actually go back to France at the time of the war. So, but also for other reasons, they were part of a company that then came here, and so they emigrated here. And three of my siblings were born in France, and myself and my brother were born here. So, you know, again, maybe this is the American experience of being both in this land, which is so fresh and new, and, you know, there's a kind of openness to this culture, and yet having, of course, you know, a family culture that was French and very defined. But I always identified with America. I never felt myself French, interesting enough.
Were you born in Islam?
Because I... No.
No.
Okay. No. Islam came... No, I was born... My parents are Catholic. Were, you know, they passed away. But... And that themselves... They themselves went through a journey because Catholicism was also extremely rigid as Protestant. I mean, everything was so rigid. And it's only now opening. And so my mother was Protestant, my father Catholic. And it sounds like nothing today. But in those days, it was huge. When they got married, they weren't allowed to marry in the church. They had to marry in the place, a little bit on one of the outer rooms. And then, but they were part, there was a Catholic movement at the time, you know, of renewal and seeing the bigger picture. And they were part, very much part of that. They had friends who were monks and priests working in that field. And my mother has always been, both parents, very much involved in the kind of evolution of the faith. And so, you know, the broadening. And so they came to Houston and formed an ecumenical chapel. It was supposed to originally be just between Christians and Jews. That was the meaning of ecumenism in those days. And then through the meeting, interestingly enough, divinely orchestrated, with a Muslim businessman on a plane when they were heading to meet the Archbishop of Canterbury, who never had time, they all of a sudden realized, well, hey, there's a whole other part. There's the Muslims, you know. So then this chapel was dedicated, completely interfaith, and then, of course, all the major religions were brought in. And so my teenage years were sort of informed with this. And therefore, you know, I did have touch to other cultures, other religions, and I think they had their first colloquium, which was all very much Sufis, interesting. But the Sufis were representing, it was all like a little hidden, different traditions. And so I had my first taste of Rumi. I heard Rumi, and I just fell in love. I had no idea. It was just a man on a sitar. Now I know it's a sitar. And a singer, one evening in Houston, Texas, in a garden, and, you know, fell in love with that, those vibrations, and the vibrations of the heart, and of the yearning heart, of that passionate, longing heart. And so, and that I found later in this path of Sufism, through Sheikh Muzaffar, you know. So,
not so yet experience of a child riding while blah, blah, blah.
That's true. Oh yeah, that's true. When I was in 11th grade, some of you are in 11th grade, this was, you know, before though, this was maybe just around that time, but I didn't have any idea of La ilaha illallah. And we had one of our classmates was from Pakistan. And one day the teacher just asked her, said, well, why don't you tell us a little bit about your religion, which was, of course, Islam. And she got on the board, and I don't remember anything she said, but I remember her saying, La ilaha illallah. She wrote on the board. And I don't know, it just went like an arrow to my heart. So I started repeating, not knowing what it meant, but I found it brought me great joy and peace. And that 11th grade was very hard for me. It was, I don't know, I hope for you it's much easier. I was going through a lot of turmoil, inner turmoil, emotional turmoil. And here was this wonderful thing. And I just kept repeating it all through my 11th grade, you know. And then gradually, you know, it probably faded out until then I met Sheikh Muzaffar, my teacher. Many years later.
Well? Was that in Houston as well?
There was a connection because the Mevlevis, yeah, it was exactly like those roots that intertwine. Yeah, but I met him here in New York actually.
So is yours the Mevlevi order?
Pardon?
Is it the Mevlevi order of
Sufism? No, this is the
Jerahi.
Now, actually, in America, part of the Jerahi has become the Nur Ashki Jerahi. So it's even more, you know,
modified.
Modified. Because why Nur Ashki? Because Jerahi was Hazreti Nuruddin Jerahi from 17th century and 18th century Istanbul. And when Sheikh Muzaffar brought this path here in 1978, he was really became the founder of a whole new spiritual tradition in America. And when he passed, his designated, dreamt of successor, called Sheikh Nur, Lex Hickson, who was an extraordinary mystic himself, even before he met Sheikh Muzaffar, you know, in different religious traditions, sacred paths. He then called us the Ashki Jerahis, because Ashki means, as you might know, the one in love, the one perpetually in love. So it's in love with God. Then that Ashki was the name of Sheikh Muzaffar, given by his sheikh. He called him Ashki. He was such. And so this was kind of, you know, it was a subtle thing. It wasn't like, but that we were sort of the Ashki Jerahis. That, in other words, love became our guide, rather than the outer form, than the outer form of the tariqah, or what we should do, or how we should, you know, wear the scarf, or the hat, or hold the tesbih. You know, these are sometimes overly defined. And so we were the Ashki Jerahis that were guided by love and inner intuition. And then after Sheikh Nur passed, it became very natural, because he was such an important also figure in this silsila, to give his name to it too. So now we are the Nur Ashki Jerahis. The meeting with the guide, that's what does it, because then your heart is initiated, that we call it initiation. And you receive, I don't know, it's a grace, it's actually divine grace that comes to you through this meeting, through this connection to the guide, and through your hand-taking, through the bayat, through the what's called the bayat, is the, you know, the linking to the heart of the guide. And it's, you know, it's not something just outer and formal. It's a reality of the heart. And it changes you like day and night. It's like it went from night to day. It doesn't mean I still have struggles. I just described my morning. You know, but it's in a different place. It's like the child who cries and maybe gets a tummy ache, but he's in the lap of his mother or her mother. You know, you're with Allah. You have the one to turn to. It's very different. It's not the despair of the one whose heart has not received that, you know, touch of grace or that kiss and that opening. Yes?
I must say, I'm really touched by the way you're speaking. It's very, very, such words of wisdom, so I must acknowledge that. But the question comes to my mind that every, you know, we know Sufism as having a spiritual aspect and, you know, a Shariat aspect, the practice of the religion.
Right.
So what does a practicing Sufi have in terms of the practices? So you do the five times?
Inshallah. But our teacher, Sheikh Muzaffar, you know, always did. So basically, we follow. You know, we don't. And so he came, he brought it here, the full, you know, five daily prayers, the fasting in the Ramadan, you know, the Hajj. We went on Hajj. And so, yes, he transmitted that. We do not, so we offer that. I call it like the banquet table of, you know, but we do not inquire, or very rarely will I ever ask someone, you know, are you doing the five daily prayers? I might recommend it in a general sense, you know, to, of course, but we all do it. We do it here, you know, in, when we gather, and so it's subtle because we want it to stay personal so that the person desires it, just the way that Rasul desired it when he saw it in paradise. He saw it and it was so beautiful to see all the angels in all the different postures of praise that actually longed for it. So that's how we desire to transmit it, to have, you know, the heart long for it, because it's innately, it's there. You know, I mean, all the sacred traditions have their particular forms of, you know, how would you say, bestowing grace. So in Islam, I mean, it's very much, of course, the Salah. But the Tesbih is very much stressed, you know, doing the Tesbih, the divine names. We say that, and in fact, more than Salah, although we do the Salah, but it's the Tesbih that,
the Zikr.
Because the Zikr is what keeps the heart, it's like the food of the heart. And the Salat is actually a very mature, it's even I think Hazreti Ali radiallahu anh said that, you know, it's for mature practitioners. And of course we learn it young, so we know it, but we don't appreciate it sometimes until much, much later. You know, and then we get tastes of how profound it is.
And how often do you do the zikr in the form of the dervish?
The whirling, the dervish circle, we do it once a week. But our own personal tesbih, we do every day. And of course, then there's the continuous tesbih, you know, that again comes usually after you've been on the path for a certain number of years, you know, where it starts to come through your heart. It's more the continuous tesbih. But we still have a fixed tesbih that we do you know, every day. It's called the daily tesbih. And it has these, you know, names like La ilaha illallah is the axis of it. So always do, that's my recommendation. Always, if you, everything else drops away, I say. If everything else of your practice and the drops away, use La ilaha illallah. Keep that, because that is, you know, there are many hadiths attesting to the blessedness of that. And that will keep our heart, you know, alive and desiring Allah. And then the rest will come.
So
but that's in a kind of grosso. Yeah.
So how often does the congregation meet?
Well, we meet like this, you know, we meet really was, we meet twice, I mean, theoretically, and many more times, because there are always occasions or events or holy days. But we meet, the main night is the Zikr night, Thursday night, the Juma night. And then we have a meshk also, where we learn the Elahis, which are very important for our order, because it, all the sacred teachings are in our Elahis. Sheikh Muzaffar, we used to say the Quran, this is the Quran in the Elahis. But it's the Quran that's passed through the heart of the friends of God, you know. But all the deep teachings of Quran. So we can sing, it's wonderful. So you have, you know, your own chants, and yeah, it's similar, our Elahis. So you, in a few questions we were discussing, one is I was asked, why, what is the name Hu? Why we say Hu? And Hu is in Holy Quran. Hu is, you know, Allah Hu, La Ilaha Illa Hu, El Hayyul Qayyum, it occurs in many, many places in the Quran. So where it designates, like, you know, He or Allah, that one, or it's almost like a third person pronoun. But the deeper meaning, according to our understanding, is it comes to mean the essence of God beyond the name. It's the name that is beyond the names. So you have Rahman, Rahim, Karim, Nur. But, you know, those are all attributes of God. But then the Hu is before them. It's the essence from which all the names arise. And we call on that, because that's where, in a sense, our soul is longing for the essence. For in the essence, you have the totality. It's like in the color white, you have all the colors. Or whether you say white or black, you know, you have all the colors. So in the essence, you have all the names. It's beyond really the name. It's almost like the person of God, the beingness of God, you know. So it's not just the light of God or the generosity of God, but it's the very almost person of the being, the very being of Allah. Where Allah says, you know, come to my side, by indahu, by him, from him, to him, within him. In fact, the Sufi path, we say toward him, and then, you know, in him, with him, and then from him, there's also a return back into the world from God. So this gets into the discussion of the path and the levels and the steps. You know, it's like the journey of life. It looks like we're just here on earth and we live so many years. But actually, our whole journey is in God, in Allah. We just don't realize it always. But as we grow, and if we, you know, as you all are, your hearts are oriented to Allah. So more and more divine illumination is going to come to you. And then, inshallah, will come a time where you feel you're just always with Allah, never separate. Because separation is when we're really unhappy, when we feel we're separate from God. That's when unhappiness comes. When we finally know that we are never separate, then everything becomes good and beautiful, no matter what. No matter what it is. That's why the Sufis say they'd rather be in the fire with God than, you know, with the beloved. They don't say God, but they say in the fire with the beloved than, you know, in a paradise empty of the beloved, in the absence of the beloved. So love is their way, love is their goal. Love is their food, love is their drink. Mm-hmm.
The questions are with
us. Yeah, the questions.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Yeah, you can ask them out loud if you want.
Sure. First one says, is there a central authority that governs the principles and teachings of Sufism through the various Sufi orders, or does each order have the mandate to practice and spread Sufi teachings as per the Sheikh's guidance?
Yes, it's more the second. There is no central authority, really, in the Sufi lineages. But the central authority, of course, is Allah, the Holy Quran, and the Prophet Muhammad, his sunnah, his teachings. And of course the teachings of the great ones, you know, Hazreti Ali and the descendants, and so that all makes like an ocean of knowledge and wisdom. So that's what we follow. But every tariqa has its own, as you say, its own permission. We call it permission. It's given permission. And so it doesn't have to take authority from anywhere else. It's very interesting, you know. Except, of course, in the times when they, if you're living in an Islamic country, sometimes the rulers feel they have the right to say certain things, the Sheikh al-Islam and all that. But really, on a deeper level, because the lineage is true, we sincerely believe, as you do, in the authenticity of the transmission. And if it's authentic, then the one who is present at that time will be speaking and guiding correctly, inshallah, you know. Because we the Sufis are not so much people who like just read the books and follow. That can be very confusing. That's what you have in the Islamic world today often. Everybody's reading hadith and reading Quran and then giving their own opinion. And, you know, it can be very confusing. Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
Okay. How does Sufism trace back its history, and how many orders exist in the world today?
Oh, well. I'm not really a historian, but I did speak somewhat earlier of, you know, there, what I understand, and again, my understanding is not necessarily complete, but that, you know, there's even an discussion of whether Sufism began before the Prophet Muhammad, whether, of course, we can say on some level, it began with the Prophet Adam, you know, already, because it was the human heart. So, but the particular flavor and teachings that we recognize as Sufi, I'd like to place them with the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him. But I do see them in Hazreti Isa, alayhi salam. You know, definitely Hazreti Isa is teaching in a Sufi way. He's teaching through parables, through inner meanings. He's teaching through love, through community, through the disciples. It's very, very Sufi. So, you know, if I would say that he opened, you know, in a sense, the era, I will call it, of Sufism by his coming, just as he announced the coming of Rasulullah. So he announce the coming of this great flowering of the Sufi path, which is really the path, the natural path of the heart to Allah. So, you know, it's impossible to say that all the prophets were Sufis, of course, on some level, because they had the inner understanding. Now, there's an interesting example in Quran, which is where the prophet Moses takes up companionship with Hither. And some people say Hither is a prophet. Some people just say he's a man who was given, you know, eternal, I mean, not eternal, but longevity on earth until, let's say, the end of the earth's time, in order to teach and spread wisdom. And so it's very interesting because Moses, in that particular account, is representing the outer, which is more the Sharia way of approaching life. He sees, you know, the good and the bad, and he doesn't understand why Hither is doing things that seemingly are bad. Do you know the story? Yeah, you know the story. So that right there is an example of the inner path, which represented by Hither. So, for example, he kills a child. It's terrible. And Moses is aghast, and at that he can't stand it anymore, you know. And then he breaks his vow, because Hither had asked him to not question him until he was completed the journey. And well, let's just tell the story briefly so it's all refreshed in our minds. Moses had been longing to meet Hither because he knew that he had knowledge, it was called direct from God, direct from Allah. And so, anyway, he finally found him, met up with him, and then Hither tells him, you will not be able to bear me because, you know, my knowledge is different from what you are given to know. So, but Moses says, please, he pleaded with him, and then Hither says, all right, but don't question me. And then they go along and they come to a river where, you know, in those days you had to, they didn't have bridges so much, you had to get across with a boat. So there was an old couple who were ferrying a boat, and that's how they made their living. And so that night they stayed there, and in the night Hither gets up, and Moses follows him, and Hither puts holes in the boat, and the boat sinks. And so Moses says, oh my God, what is he doing? You know, what is he doing? He couldn't understand, because he was an old couple, very nice couple, and he goes and damages their sole source of living. So, okay, but he doesn't say anything. So then they walk and walk and come to another place, a town, and it's nighttime, and there are children playing around the well. And they're drinking, and the children are giving them water from the well to drink because they see they're tired and thirsty. And then all of a sudden, Hither, from under his cloak, takes a dagger, and there's a young boy there, and he stabs the boy and kills him. And, you know, but no one sees because it's all in the dusk. So Moses says, I mean, you know, it's already getting too much beyond his ability to keep silent. And then they travel on, and then they come to another town. And at that town, the people stone them, are very cruel to them. And so as they are leaving, so they didn't give them anything to eat, and they actually tell them to leave. Very unpleasant townspeople. And as they're leaving, they're the wall of the town, those days the towns had walls around them to protect them, is crumbling in a certain place, and Hither stops and, you know, makes a lot of effort to repair the wall. And then Moses just breaks down and says, this is it, you know, I can't hold my silence anymore. What is going on here? You've sunk the boat of a lovely old couple who depended on it for a living. You killed a child, and now you're rebuilding the wall of these townspeople who are really not nice at all. And Hither said, I told you, you wouldn't be able to bear my knowledge. So Hither reveals to him the reason for his actions. And he said, in the first place, he said there was a pirate, a robber, going around stealing boats from everyone. And he said, by putting a hole and having the boat, I mean, the boat didn't sink in the depth of water, it just sank right there at the shore. He was saving the boat, actually, because the robber would, of course, not take a sunken boat, and then they would repair it, and then they would continue making their living that way. And he said, in the second place, when they came to the town, and that boy, he said that boy was going to grow up to be a tyrant, and cause a lot of harm to people, and hurt, break the hearts of his parents, and so he just killed him. But of course, by Allah's command, Hither doesn't do anything on his own. And he said the couple will have a new child born to them who will be, you know, a beautiful child, a true servant and friend of Allah, and will be a blessing to his parents. So that was the second instance. And in the third, he said, in the town there were two orphans whose father, because this was such a nasty town of nasty people, the father had hidden their inheritance when he was dying, and they were going to be orphans, and he knew that he couldn't trust the people of the town. So with a very special prayer to Allah, he prayed and he hid the inheritance in the wall. And it was promised to him that the children would someday, you know, by divine design, come and find their inheritance in the wall, so they would receive it. So that is the explanation. So Hither is the model, in a way, of Sufism, which isn't always comprehensible, the knowledge that comes. That's why it's very much a path of trusting, putting one's trust, but it is teaching one to put one's trust in Allah. You know, because life is like Hither. Things happen to us. It's like journeying with Hither. Hither is our companion in our life all the time. We're late for school and we just missed the bus, or, you know, something happens. So we get sick just on the day when we're supposed to be in some athletic meet and we feel we could win. Or, I mean, all these events happen to us frequently. But by placing our trust in Allah, we know that it's for the good and that something better will come to us. So it's a teaching. And the Sufi tariqas are simply training us to be with Allah, training us to trust in Allah, training us to remember Allah at all times, training us to trust enough to be able to love, to open our hearts. You know, so they're not creating something separate. They're really a path of guidance and a path of intimate teachings. It's intimacy, Sufism about intimacy with Allah. So what's the next question?
What are the commonalities and distinctions among different Sufi orders existing in the world today?
Yeah. I mean, they all have common origin, common intention, more or less, you know, which is... I mean, but they can be quite different, too. Some are more close than others. So, you know, you have some Sufi orders that... I mean, in actuality, I'm not saying theoretically... Their intention is the same. Their origin is the same. Their goal is the same. But actually, the way it works out, they're not always the same. You know, the way they work is not always the same because they come in different cultures and they have different, what's called meshreb. A meshreb is like a style or a fragrance, you know. So each of us goes, it's like a field of flowers. Let's say Sufism would be you walk into this field and your eye, your heart is going to be attracted to one flower over all others. So that's how, in a way, how dervishes, you know, go to their tariqas. Each one is slightly different. You know, they're all concerned with educating both the nafs and with guiding the heart to Allah, to revealing the heart in Allah, really. So, alhamdulillah. What's your next question? Oh, we're going fast now.
Who selects the sheikhs in a Sufi order and what is their role and contribution?
Read that again.
Who selects the sheikhs in a Sufi order and what is their role and contribution?
Okay. So the... We spoke earlier how the sheikh is selected really by the dervishes themselves, but really by Allah, but then revealing in dervish hearts dreams, pointing to the successor, pointing to the next one. So it's not a matter of personal will or rational decision, you know, it's really from Allah, but it comes through the heart. So it comes to the heart of the dervishes. So they will, the sheikh will, it will always appear in dreams. You know, the Pope, for instance, is chosen by the cardinals. Now, of course, we can say that's Allah's design too. Everything is Allah's will. There's nothing outside of Allah's will in the world. But the manner, the vessel is different. So in the Sufi tariqa, the vessel is through dream and through the heart.
Mm-hmm. Is Sufism connected to only Islam?
Oh, there was another part of the question. What is the role of the sheikh? So, the role of the sheikh, almost like an image, is more like one role is a mirror. One role is, of course, to initiate dervishes, to be a door. I often think of myself, I'm just like a door or sometimes even a doormat, but you know, to bring dervishes into to Allah, to call people to Allah. It's all Allah. It's not to sit here and be someone. It's really to be the doorway to Allah. That's, I would say, is the greatest. And of course, to give counsel, to encourage. You know, all of those functions are there too, a more nourishing and you might call it mothering or supportive or educational role. But the central function is to basically call all of you to Allah. Yeah.
Is Sufism connected to only Islam, or can people of other religions like Judaism, Christianity, Hinduism, Buddhism, and other major religions of the world allow to practice Sufism and become dervishes without leaving their religion of birth?
Yes. I mean, it's a very interesting question, and I think here in America we are testing this question. You know, we're theoretically, absolutely. We have, you know, people in our zikr circle or who are from different backgrounds now, and who do practice in other traditions. But there is, every tradition is like a, you know, powerful magnet. So there's no question that Sufism and Islam is a very powerful magnet. So it has its own very full set of, you know, practices, prayers, devotions. So I would say it depends on the individual. Our Sheikh Noor practiced in different traditions. He was a student and he was a disciple in the five main traditions. Amazing, five or six. He seriously discipled. Now, in general, he did them one after the other. But at a certain point, he was studying at the Christian Orthodox monastery and being the Sufi sheikh. Now, when they found out, after his own mentor died, Father Alexander, who loved Noor and understood him and understood his own mission. This was part of his mission. He didn't choose to do this. It was part of his spiritual work. Then they didn't let him study there anymore after Father Alexander passed, and that was heartbreaking to Noor. But here in Sufism, there's not really a problem because all of the traditions, theoretically, I mean, they're all coming from the same, it's the whole prophetic tradition, so there's no problem, you know. But the problem comes more with your own capacity. How much capacity do you have, let's say, to plunge into, you know, the Sufi Islamic path and then, you know, let's say an Orthodox Jewish path? I don't think that's possible because both are too demanding. Maybe there are other, you know, that you can meditate, you can do other forms of practice. But it's interesting. Sheikh Noor said, yes, you can have parallel paths. You know, the human being is capable of that. And so it's something for these times maybe to explore, because ultimately Allah is beyond all path. Allah is not the path. The path has a goal, and the goal is Allah. So that's what we want, is the goal. And sometimes, you know, we confuse the goal with the path. And we say, oh, well, it's the religion. That's what matters. Matters what religion I'm in. What matters is your heart. Has your heart reached God? Is your heart merged in God? That's what matters. It doesn't matter. When we come to God and we say, oh, I was a Jew, I was a Christian, or I was this or I was that, God's going to look at our heart and say, you know, if God sees in the mirror of our heart the beauty shining back, of the divine beauty shining back, then God would say, yes, you know, your path was good. But alhamdulillah. In general, yes. So I would say yes to that question if you want a simple answer. Mm-hmm. What's next?
Can a person practice Sufism and still be able to maintain a balance between din and dunya, or would he have to retract from worldly life?
No. The Islamic path is very balanced. You know, it's... But again, that question has many layers. You can be a lover of God and be in the world, be married, have children, have a career, you know, or be an athlete. You can do everything that's good, ta'ib. You know, you can do what's pure. Not, obviously, you can't have a business that abuses people. That is not, harmonious with the path. But everything that's good and pure. And Allah has said, I have made everything good and pure here. So, yes. But at a certain point, you know, there are times when, specifically when dervishes might retreat. Maybe for a week, there are the traditional retreats are 40 days, you know. But those are not practiced. In some tariqas they are, not so much in ours. But we would do short retreats, like 3 days of intense prayer. And yes, Ali.
What's the difference between the world as it is and the dunya that's in our head?
Yeah, that's a good question. So the world, because I was, yeah, exactly, that's the more, the other level, subtle level, is that ultimately this path is, you won't be in the dunya anymore. The dunya is just like the limited self, it's like the ego. So the dunya is where, you know, we're separate from God. The dunya is where it's just about me or just a confusion. So the world, what we call this earth, this creation, is pure. It's utterly pure. It's just purely divine light. But it's how we see it. And the dunya is simply how we see it. If we see it with eyes that are pure and see the beauty and see God everywhere, then it's not dunya. You know, and we can do anything in this world, and it will be good. But if we see it as a way just to take advantage, or for myself, or we feel like totally separate from God, then all we're going to see is dunya here. So that's why the paths of purification are so important, because by purifying our heart of all other, then we come to the pristine awareness, you know, the pure truth that is always here. It's always here. It's just our own perception. So all we're doing really in all these paths is just polishing our own means of vision, you know. Like if I would have these glasses, if I'd let's say go through some mud, they get all splattered. That's the dunya. I can't see, it's all muddy and confusing. I don't know where I'm going. As soon as I polish them and see clearly, like I see all your shining faces, this is pristine creation. This is Allah's light. I see you, this is all Allah's light here. Yeah, so if that's not too confusing. You had a question?
Yeah, that's not on the list, but you said before that Allah knows everything and everything is therefore predetermined or predestined. So do you believe that there is such a thing as human free will?
Yeah, well, I mean, that's, yeah, in a way, but it's limited. Our Sheikh gave the example. This is an example of free will. So the train is going in a certain direction. And you're walking in the, you know, up and down the train. So that's your kind of free will. It's just an image. Because free will comes at a certain level of seeing. In other words, we all must take responsibility for ourselves. So we can't just say, oh, I'm not going to do anything, you know, that obviously that's what Allah wants, so I'm just going to sit here and be depressed, or that's all written. No. My responsibility is to be the best being that I can be. That's my divinely given responsibility. And for that, I am given the power that we call free will to do that, to make those decisions. Now, ultimately, of course, there is a destiny. We don't know it. But usually when people say, oh, that's they lower the bar so much. The human potential and capacity is so high that, you know, we have to say we don't know Allah's destiny until it happens. So obviously if something has happened, then we say that's Allah's destiny, you know. But we need to use what we call our free will to the greatest potential we can, absolutely. So, and that's called striving, you know, and that's talked about in Quran all the time. Those who strive, those who earnestly strive, you know, and the path of life needs that. Like if you, anything you want to do, you have to strive for. It's part of our human condition. And so that is in that domain of free will. Yeah, so we have to use our, again, it's just a term, I rather call it a human capacity, a human responsibility or ability given by God for us to use. Yeah. Yeah, what's next?
What level of dedication is required to become a dervish, and how much time does it take?
What is the role of dervish in the Sufi order?
Wow, that's a great question. Oh, what was the first part?
What level of dedication is required to become a dervish, and how much time does it take?
Well, okay, I'll tell you a little secret. Most dervishes do not know what they're getting into. So, you know, they'll take the leap or the step, and they'll just be attracted. It'll come first through attraction. They're drawn. Oh, they say, this is very nice, you know. And I'd like to take hand. Or they'll have a dream that, you know, indicates they should take hand. Some come more intensely, like, you know, I must do this. I have no other choice. But many come, you know, with a kind of nice springtime feeling, oh, this is nice. And then once they're in, though, you know, it's like you get pulled in. But this is just Allah pulling us. This isn't like us in this building or this Sufi order which has, you know, designs on people. Not at all. This is the way of God. God desires us, and God is the greatest lover. And so God desires each of us, and that's why we've been, you know, created and manifested. And so, you know, one way or another, it's the greatest blessing is to be pulled in by God. So ultimately, it's our whole life you give to the dervish. But, you know, your whole life you want to give to God.
I think we'll take just one more question.
Okay.
How do Sufis adopt traditions that belong to different Sufi orders? What are the specific traditions or cultural aspects of the Nirakshi order? For example, the whirling dervishes wear white gowns and draw to music.
Mm-hmm. That's a very interesting question. And again, our Sheikh Noor said this is a great experiment. Because, you know, this tradition comes out of a more traditional culture, of course, the East. It's coming into the West, where not only Islam is not prevalent, but, you know, any Sufi orders. Now, it's changing very rapidly today. I mean, Sufism is really spreading very rapidly. So, but, you know, when Sheikh Muzaffar came in 1978, people had no idea what Sufism was and who's Rumi. And they really, everything today that seems so, you know, prevalent and common. So we strive in this order to, and our Sheikh Noor, who was a Westerner, acted almost like a big filter against the cultural things. So it's not about culture. It's not about, you know, since we come from Turkey, about bringing Turkish culture here and doing things the way they do there. It's about bringing the love of God, the profound teachings of Rasulullah, the, you know, oceanic teachings of the Quran and all that. This is what it's about. So we can do that dressed in jeans, you know, and without a headscarf. We're just as intelligent and just as open and as loving. So we don't need to adapt to, you know, the culture. And before, everyone was smoking. So the Turks are wonderful smokers. The whole Tekke was just, you know, and our sheikh was a smoker. So, you know, I started smoking. I mean, me, who's, you know, the least smoker. And, but he stopped smoking the last 6 months of his life, interesting enough. That's how rad. And here's a man, all his life he had smoked. He stopped smoking, or maybe the last year of his life, because, you know, he didn't want that to become a form that people would adopt, thinking, oh, this is Sufism. Like, if we all get around and drink tea and smoke cigarettes, you know, that's Sufism. No. You know, Sufism is simply the love of the heart and that particular linkage of heart to heart. So, yeah.
You had said earlier that you had dervishes have this pull, this initial attraction. So since that initial attraction, since initiation, since Baya, how have you evolved, or how are you evolving as a person, as a soul, and how does it influence your life?
Oh, totally. Totally, it's just, I mean, you know, that I'm totally taken in, but, I mean, you know, you go on being a person who fails, who's needs to correct themselves, who needs to turn to Allah and ask forgiveness, and you're a person who has wonderful moments and openings, and you know what I mean? It's just that, how is it? You know, the difference. For me, it was coming like from death to life, honestly. Just what it says in the Quran. Allah brings the soul from darkness. You know, have you ever read that? Into light. That's what it was for me. I mean, and I felt I was, you know, looking from where I am now, as much as I say, as a fallible, you know, failing kind of person. But if I look back, I realize that I feel I was just like almost dead spiritually or half dead. So now I feel alive, very different. You know, very different. Yeah. One more question.
Is this mosque open all day?
No, it's not, because it's not really. It's a Sufi. In other words, it's mainly a Sufi house, but that we offer to be a mosque on Friday.
Oh, okay.
So it's open on Juma to the public. Let's say to the Muslim public. And of course, Muslims can come for zikr, but it's not open. It functions more for the Sufi community, and we have publications, and you know, we work here. In fact, I want to give you a few books before you go. Did I give you books last time?
No.
So I want to give you a few books. I hope, yeah.
There was one question which was actually very interesting. We had
actually. Okay, let's ask it.
And that last question, which I think many of the students are interested in. There's some mysticism about the number 28.
28.
Mm-hmm. No, it's
28. Well, that's the names.
Yeah.
Well, 28. There are 28 days in the month. You know, the lunar. 28 is a mystical number in the sense that it's woven into. It's one of the kind of foundational principles of creation. So all the Sufi orders have the certain divine names. So they all have La ilaha illallah, Allahu. Hay, Kayum, Kahat, you know, and they, through time, historically, those names increased. So you would get, you know, a sheikh who was given by Allah more names for their dervishes. So it's said, you know, I haven't gone out and interviewed, you know, other orders, but it's part of the knowledge that's spoken of in our order, that the 28th was the completion of the divine names necessary, in a sense, maybe not the word necessary isn't good, but for the final flowering. Like almost, let's say you had a rose, and you give it certain, you know, foods, and it keeps opening and opening, but then, you know, you give it the complete food with the 28 names, and it's going to blossom completely. All the petals are going to open. In that sense, one can, and it's just a metaphor, but the 28, they're all names of Allah. And, you know, some we spoke in the zikr. So, and it's the called the suluk, the path. So we progress really often through the names. I mean, often is the right word. The main name is La ilaha illallah in our understanding, Muhammad Rasulullah, Allah, and who, those three. There are also 28 prophets mentioned in Holy Quran. That's another occurrence of the 28. Yeah. And the 28 letters, exactly, of the alphabet. So they are foundational. Yeah.
So